From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Today's the day that we're either going to unbolt ourselves from John Bolton and the UN or make a decision that America can do everything alone in the world.
John Bolton showdown. Democrats continue to seek to delay a vote on Bush's pick for ambassador to the UN. Colin Powell's chief of staff calls the choice abysmal. Then the New York District Attorney's Office is preparing to dismiss charges connected to one of the Republican convention's most high-profile arrests.
After 7 long months, I'm very happy to have these charges finally coming to an end, and me and my family can finally go home and continue on with the lives that we are used to.
But first, today marks the 10th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing that killed 168 people.
My 23-year-old daughter Julie was killed in the bombing on April the 19th, 1995.
We'll speak with the father of one of the victims. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, a series of assassinations and bombings have been reported across the country over the past day. In Baghdad, a suicide car bomb exploded outside of one of Saddam Hussein's former palaces. 6 Iraqis died. Another 30 people were injured. Gunmen dressed in army uniforms raided the Baghdad home of a senior defense advisor, killing him and his son. Meanwhile, in southern Iraq, the inspector general responsible for southern provinces was shot dead in his car. A top academic in Baghdad was also assassinated earlier today. The head of the German language department at Baghdad University was shot dead outside his West Baghdad home. As a sign of the deteriorating security situation in Iraq, the Filipino government has called on all of its citizens to leave the country. Some 6,000 Filipinos work in Iraq, many for the U.S. military. 2 Filipinos died in Iraq last week. In other news from Iraq, a member of the newly formed Iraqi National Assembly has accused U.S. soldiers of abusing him at a U.S.-run checkpoint. The Shiite lawmaker Fatah al-Sheikh said a U.S. soldier kicked his car, mocked the legislature, handcuffed him, and held him by the neck. Al-Sheikh said, quote, "This shows the democracy we're enjoying is fake. Through such incidents, the U.S. Army tries to show that they're the real controlling power in the country, not the new Iraqi government, and that they can impose their rules on every Iraqi," he said. U.S. forces said they were investigating the incident. The Washington Post is reporting in August 2003, Army intelligence officials in Iraq began discussing different types of harsh interrogation techniques that they wished could be permitted in U.S.-run Iraqi jails. In one email, Captain William Ponce asked interrogators to submit wish lists of different types of interrogation techniques that could be used. In the email, Ponce wrote, quote, "The gloves are coming off. Techniques submitted included low-voltage electrocution, blows with phone books, and the use of dogs and snakes around detainees. 2 specific cases of abuse in Iraq occurred soon after, including one where a man died." On Capitol Hill, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is scheduled to vote today on the nomination of John Bolton to serve as ambassador to the United Nations. The New York Times reports the top Democrat on the committee, Joseph Biden of Delaware, is planning to ask for the vote to be delayed. A series of new allegations on Bolton abusing his power at the State Department have emerged since the committee last met. In addition, on Monday, Secretary of State Colin Powell's former chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, spoke out in opposition to Bolton. He told the New York Times, quote, "He's incapable of listening to people and taking into account their views. He would be an abysmal ambassador," he said. Powell has not publicly commented on Bolton's nomination. We'll have more on Bolton in just a few minutes. The Washington Post is reporting that Zacharias Massawi has notified the government he intends to plead guilty to his alleged role in the September 11th attacks. Massawi's plan to plead guilty reportedly comes over his attorney's objections. A judge will be meeting with Massawi later this week to determine if he's mentally competent to enter a plea. Massawi entered a guilty plea in 2002, then rescinded it a week later. His trial has been delayed numerous times in the 40 months since he was indicted. Moussaoui was arrested a month before the September 11th attacks after a flight instructor in Minnesota alerted the FBI to what appeared to be suspicious behavior. At one point, the government had concluded Moussaoui was meant to be the 20th hijacker, but officials have since concluded the planners of the September 11th attacks ended up leaving Moussaoui out of the final plan because they viewed him as too unstable. Moussaoui will likely face the death penalty if he pleads guilty. At the Vatican, Catholic cardinals have entered a second day of voting to elect a new pope. Votes taken Monday afternoon and this morning were both inconclusive. 115 cardinals have isolated themselves inside the Sistine Chapel during the process known as the conclave. The cardinals will cast as many as 4 ballots a day. Twice a day, the ballots will be burned. Black smoke signals an inconclusive vote. White smoke indicates a new pope has been chosen. Meanwhile, a group of Catholic women are holding a conclave of their own to protest the church's stance blocking women from becoming priests or from allowing women any role in selecting the new pope. A group called Women Church Convergence launched an online open conclave to allow, quote, the entire community of faith to make their views known about important issues in the church's life. In Belgium, police have arrested some 500 activists taking part in a citizens' nuclear weapons inspection at a NATO airbase. Organized by Greenpeace and the group Bomb Spotting, the protest called on NATO to become a nuclear-free alliance and for the U.S. to pull its nuclear weapons from all NATO countries. Greenpeace estimates 480 nuclear weapons are now housed in 6 European nations: Italy, Germany, Belgium, Britain, Turkey, and the Netherlands. Activists from all 6 countries took part in the so-called citizen inspections. The Israeli government announced today former nuclear whistleblower Mordechai Vanunu will be barred for another year from leaving the country. Vanunu was released from jail last April after serving 18 years behind bars for exposing Israel's secret nuclear weapons program. Under the original conditions of his prison release, Vanunu was going to be allowed to leave Israel within a year. But Israel's crackdown on Vanunu's rights after he conducted a series of interviews with the international press, including on Democracy Now! Israel's interior minister said today the country fears Vanunu will continue to speak about Israel's nuclear program. Vanunu has maintained he has no more secrets and has repeatedly called on Israel to allow him to leave the country.
As a human being, I have the right to express my political views, my ideas. I have no more any secret. And the only one who have secret is Israel government. Israel government has nuclear weapons, and they have this secret. I don't have any more secret.
That was Mordechai Vanunu speaking last week in Israel. You can go to our website for the hour interview with him at democracynow.org. The government of Iran has temporarily banned Al Jazeera from operating inside the country. The satellite TV station has been accused of inflaming protests by the country's Arab minority in southwestern Iran. The network was the first media outlet to report on the demonstrations that have left at least 3 people dead. Stun gun manufacturer Taser is back in the news. In California, the family of a 40-year-old killed in a Taser shooting has sued the city of Fresno and the Taser company for $25 million. Meanwhile, in Orlando, Florida, a police officer is now facing criminal charges for shooting a handcuffed man with a Taser gun in order to force him to give a urine sample. In California, a graduate student at the California Institute of Technology named Billy Cottrell was sentenced Monday to 8 years in prison for setting fire to an SUV dealership. The fire destroyed about 125 SUVs, causing over $2 million in damage. In addition to the jail sentence, Cottrell was ordered to pay $3.5 million in retribution. Last year, Cottrell told the Los Angeles Times by email he was affiliated with the Earth Liberation Front. 4 years ago, Jeffrey Lures was sentenced to nearly 23 years in prison for the burning of 3 SUVs in Eugene, Oregon. In labor news, graduate teaching assistants at Yale and Columbia universities launched a 5-day strike on Monday. The striking workers are hoping to force administrators to recognize them as a union. The work action has been described as the first multi-campus Ivy League strike. Last year, the National Labor Relations Board dealt graduate students' teaching assistants a setback when it ruled they're students and not workers, meaning they cannot form unions. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, Trees in the City by Clear Lake, the music. I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the 10th anniversary of the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. There are memorial commemorations there and in other cities around the country. In all, some 168 people were killed that day, 19 of them children, many of whom died as they played in their daycare center. Two men were convicted in the attack, Timothy McVeigh, executed a few years ago, and Terry Nichols, who remains in prison. At the time, the Oklahoma City bombing was considered to be the worst terror attack in U.S. history. To look back on that day, we go now to Oklahoma City. We're joined on the phone by Bud Welch. His 23-year-old daughter, Julie, was killed 10 years ago today. He's speaking to us from the memorial service on his cell phone. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bud Welch.
Thanks. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you describe the scene right now?
Well, actually, the scene is still pretty quiet. It's quite early. Of course, it's just shortly after 7 o'clock here. However, I would guess that there's probably already a couple of hundred people in the area. And we're expecting a very large crowd that will gather here by 9 o'clock.
If you can, and I hate to ask you to do this, but could you go back 10 years ago to that day on April 19th, 2005, and 1995, and talk about the morning? Where were you?
I was at home that morning, and I live about 8 miles from the Murrah Building. And when the bomb went off, it shook my house violently. It did not break any windows, but not far from us, it did break windows out of homes. And, of course, I couldn't imagine what had taken place. I learned within about 10 or 12 minutes after that that the Murrah Building indeed had been bombed. I saw it on television, and I gave up all hope that Julie could have survived because all I could see was a pile of rubble about 25 feet high, and I knew that she worked on the first floor. And I remained at home for 48 hours by the telephone because I knew that if Julie got out of the building, that the first thing that she would do would be to call me. And I'm out of a large family and had family members at every hospital in the metropolitan area. Actually, as far away as 40 miles.
What did she do at the Oklahoma City building? What was her job?
Julie was Spanish translator for the Social Security Administration. She had been a foreign exchange student for 1 year in high school, lived with a family in Pontevedra, Galicia, Spain, and had won a foreign language scholarship to Marquette University in Milwaukee. And Julie had graduated from there in 1994 with a degree in Spanish and a minor in French and Italian. And Julie had learned to speak five languages, and that morning she had an appointment with a Mexican man that could not speak English, and she had left her office at the rear of the Murrah Building and went to the front to the Social Security waiting room to get her client, who had been brought by his minister, and the three of them were returning to her office and got about halfway through the building when the bomb went off at 9:02, and that was on Wednesday morning. And all three bodies were found together on Saturday.
You became well known because you spoke out against the death penalty. Timothy McVeigh has since been executed. But can you talk about your feelings? And on that day, on April 19th, 1995, were you opposed to the death penalty?
All of my life I've been opposed to the death penalty. That goes back through my parents, even my grandparents. And it was never a big issue for me at all, because I had never been caught on either side of it. And I had been told occasionally by a friend, if I made the remark that I opposed the death penalty, they would say, if it ever happens to you, you'll change your mind. And immediately after the bombing, after Tim McVeigh and Terry Nichols had been arrested and charged, and that took place by about the time Julie's body was found, I have to tell you that the vengeance and the hate that I had in me was so strong that I didn't even want trials for McVeigh or Nichols. And I kept that anger, that hard anger, for probably a month. Then I finally accepted the fact, after about 4 weeks, that we had to have trials to hopefully learn the truth. I still struggled with the death penalty issue for another 9 or 10 months beyond that. I spent 37 years running Texaco service stations here in Oklahoma City. And I'd close my Texaco station at night, and the first thing that I would do when I'd arrive at home is make a drink. And if I drank enough, when I went to bed, I could go to sleep. It was the next day that I was paying for it. And this kept escalating over this several-month period. The hangovers were lasting till mid-morning, then midday. Probably the last 30 days of that 10-month period, they were lasting all day long. And I came to the bomb site each day after Julie's death. I had a special closeness, by being here, because, of course, that was the last place she was alive. And I actually was to meet Julie that Wednesday at 11:30 to have lunch with her. We tried to meet each Wednesday for lunch. And I remember coming at the end of January. It was about 3 in the afternoon. My head was splitting from abusing alcohol the night before, the self-medication that I was doing. And I went to asking myself a whole series of questions. What did I need to do to be able to move forward? Because I was stuck on April the 19th of 95. And three questions stuck out in my mind for probably 20 or 25 days, and that is, do you need trials to begin now? Because the first trial did not start for 25 months. Do you need convictions, and do you need executions? And those weighed heavy on my mind for the next 3 weeks, and I finally came to the conclusion that the day that we might take Tim McVeigh or Terry Nichols from their cage to kill them would be an act of revenge and hate, and revenge and hate is the very reason that Julie and 167 others are dead in this great city today. It was the vengeance that McVeigh and Nichols had against the United States government for what had happened at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, and what had happened at Waco, Texas, April the 19th, 1993. The Murrah Building bombing was the second anniversary of Waco. And I could see what their vengeance, how that had pushed them off the table, so to speak, and I knew I needed to redirect mine. And I was able to start reconciling things at that point, and going through the long process of finally actually even being able to forgive Tim McVeigh 5.5 years later.
We're talking to Bud Welch. His daughter, Julie, 23 years old, was killed 10 years ago in the Oklahoma City bombing. He is on a cell phone at the memorial site today. The memorial will begin soon. You met with Timothy McVeigh's father?
Yes, I did. I was in western New York, the Buffalo Niagara Falls area, in 1998 in September for a speaking engagement. I had gone there for 7 days, and prior to going there, I had received a telephone call 38 months after the bombing. This was in June of 1998 from a nun from Attica Prison, and she does minister work there. And the purpose of her call was for me to go there and speak out against the death penalty. I had been in Syracuse in April 2 months earlier. And that's how she got my name and telephone number. And I told her the story of seeing Bill McVeigh about 3 weeks after the bombing on television, and how I could see this deep pain in this father's eye. And I knew at that point that someday, even though I was so angry then that I didn't even want a trial for his son, that someday I was going to need to go tell that man that I truly cared how he felt for his family, for what his son had done. And I had the chance to do that nearly 3.5 years later. And when I went to Bill's house, I knocked on the door, and I had learned the night before after a speech from people that knew him that Bill was extremely shy and didn't talk much. But his hobby each summer is growing a very large garden in his backyard. He lives on about two acres of land. And after I knocked on the door, I said to Bill, I said, Bill, I understand you have a nice garden in your backyard. And when I said that, this big guy, he's about 6'3", his face lit up like you'd thrown a spotlight on him, got this big smile on his face, and he said, yeah, would you like to see it? And I said, I'd love to. I knew when I was following him through his garden to his backyard that we would find common ground. And we spent about a half hour in the garden and about an hour and a half in the house just getting to know one another. And when I left his house 2 hours later, I recognized at that moment that I really had met a bigger victim of the Oklahoma City bombing than myself. And I say that in spite of the fact I no longer have Julie. I travel all over the world speaking. I speak strongly against the death penalty. Julie was strongly against the death penalty. And when I speak, I always brag on Julie. I tell wonderful stories about her and some things that she did and things that we did together. And I don't have to tell people the ugly things that she did, and she darn sure did her share of those as well. But when Bill McVeigh awakens each morning, he awakens with that noose around his neck that his son was convicted of killing Julie Welch and 167 others. And I think it's very difficult for Bill each day. And, you know, Bill has done the same thing that I've done now. Bill has buried a child. And, you know, when your parents die, you go to the hilltop and you bury them. When your children die, you bury them in your heart, and it's forever. You never get beyond that.
Well, Bud Welch, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bud Welch, standing at the memorial that is about to begin, lost his daughter Julie on April 19th, 1995, 10 years ago today. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Written on the Sky by Max Richter here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast in over 330 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV and 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org, where you can also sign up there for our daily headlines and media alerts. We are closed captioned on our TV broadcasts for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman. A vote on the nomination of John Bolton to serve as President Bush's ambassador to the United Nations is scheduled for today. The New York Times reports the top Democrat on the committee, Joseph Biden of Delaware, is planning to ask the vote to be delayed. A series of new allegations of Bolton abusing his power at the State Department have emerged since the committee last met. Much of the 2 days of hearings last week focused on allegations that Bolton threatened intelligence analysts who disagreed with him and sought to have them removed after they challenged his claims about security threats posed by various countries. Since then, reports have emerged that during his time at the State Department, Bolton often blocked then-Secretary of State Colin Powell, and on one occasion, his successor, Condoleezza Rice, from receiving information vital to U.S. strategies on Iran. Powell was not among the group of five Republican former secretaries of state who sent the committee a letter that endorsed Bolton's nomination. On Monday, Powell's former chief of staff, Lawrence Wilkerson, spoke out in opposition to Bolton. He told the New York Times, quote, "He is incapable of listening to people and taking into account their views. He would be an abysmal ambassador," he said. During last week's hearings, Bolton acknowledged making 10 requests over 4 years for names of U.S. officials whose conversations with foreigners were monitored by the National Security Agency. Every Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is expected to vote against Bolton. If one Republican joins them, Bolton's confirmation will be blocked. Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island has said he's uncommitted. And over the weekend, Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska said he had some reservations. But the panel's Republican chair, Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, says he expects all 10 Republicans ultimately to vote in favor of the nomination. To talk further about John Bolton, we're joined on the line by Stephen Clemens. He's the publisher of the popular political blog WashingtonNote.com. He's senior fellow at the New America Foundation, where he co-directs the American Strategy Program. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Greetings, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, why don't you tell us the latest?
Well, you gave a very good reprise. What has really been unfolding with John Bolton is that the vote originally was scheduled for last Thursday, and those people like myself who've been working hard to try to get Bolton rejected by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee did get a delay until today and Tuesday. And every day that has gone by, another major revelation about John Bolton's activities has emerged. And Senators Chris Dodd and Joe Biden are yet again going to try again today. I don't know if we'll succeed. But even after the vote today, if the Republicans do stay together, there are two important things. This will be the first Bush diplomatic nominee where all eight Democrats have actually voted in unison against. That's not happened before. Secondly, we also will then go to the Senate floor, and that will take some time. And I've already learned, in fact, on my blog today, thewashingtonnote.com, I'm posting in a few moments, new allegations that have come up about Mr. Bolton's abusive behavior and attempts to get people fired, both at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which he went on to in 1993, but he was also rejected a return to his law firm, Covington & Burling, by senior partners because of their concerns over his abusive behavior. So this question about serial abuse is actually more dramatic than many of us had realized.
Can you talk more specifically about this? I mean, these are new revelations.
Yeah, these are brand new. They've come out from people who fear retribution from Bolton if they're out there. But what we hope to do is connect them with media. But essentially, at Covington, Covington had, you know, which was the law firm that John Bolton had served in before he became an assistant attorney general in the Department of Justice. And it's very remarkable for someone as well-connected as John Bolton to be refused entry back into a law firm in an inside-the-beltway setting where access to power, in this case it was John Bolton's very, very close proximity both to President Reagan and the previous President Bush, as well as Jesse Helms, and the law firm said no. These senior partner meetings are very secret. But we were able to get one person to talk. Secondly, I'm still tracing down this question on this U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. It's one of these standalone government commissions that's established that, you know, you get members of the commission to sort of preside over some important policy question the U.S. government is interested in. John Bolton served as a commissioner on this. But there are two individuals who apparently were harassed at great lengths by John Bolton, both of whom work at different institutions today. Now, what's important about this is there are two angles on Bolton that are very important. One is this surprising abusive behavior question and the lengths to which John Bolton takes his vindictiveness. That's a workplace ethic issue and something, and it's really struck a chord in the American public that none of us expected. The more important, in my view, question is how John Bolton has so frequently been a loose cannon in American foreign policy. And these are the areas that I've tried to outline most, one of which you got into with the NSA intercepts issue. The NSA intercepts are intercepts that the National Security Agency, these are our most secret secrets in the country, and John Bolton may have very well been spying on other officials that he worked with to get a fix on not only what they were saying about policy, but what they were saying about him. And that is the big question that we don't have answered yet. But Senator Dodd is working very, very hard to explore the 10 cases of NSA intercepts that John Bolton pursued. Secondly, In July 31, 2003, John Bolton was very frustrated with the direction of the Bush administration's North Korea policy. We were on the eve of launching the first round of what are called the six-party talks with North Korea. And John Bolton decided to impose himself on South Korea. South Korea didn't want to provide him a venue. Gave his speech, which had not gone through the full clearance process, and essentially threw a grenade into the middle of this delicate process of negotiation with the North Koreans at that time, which was among our highest national security objectives, because trying to tie down North Korea's nuclear pretensions and ambitions. And Bolton gave this incredible speech, after which North Korean leadership called him human scum, earning Bolton's, you know, obvious fury for obvious reasons. North Korea is not an easy country to deal with. But that doesn't take away from the fact that Bolton himself went to extraordinary lengths to sabotage Secretary Powell, Richard Armitage, and our ambassador, our envoy dealing with this North Korean nuclear issue, Charles Pritchard, and was at odds frequently. This is just one case of many other cases where Bolton's loose cannon style was amazing. I'll just share you one anecdote. Brent Scowcroft the other day gave a speech at the School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, and you know, ironically, it was the Dag Hammarskjöld lecture, Dag Hammarskjöld being the first Secretary General of the UN. And Scowcroft was asked a question about what he thought about Bolton's confirmation and or nomination. And Scowcroft replied by saying that he thought Bolton was a very smart man, someone who knew a lot about the UN. But he says what really mattered most, and this he said to an audience on listening to every, he says what matters most are the instructions John Bolton is given and whether he can follow them. And the crowd burst out laughing because Scowcroft had this look of just basically implying that Bolton cannot follow instructions, that he's constantly off the reservation. And so the concerns about Bolton are very, very widespread. What's shocking is the degree to which the Republicans, Chuck Hagel, Lincoln Chafee, and others haven't already jumped ship, because they can't vote for this guy and then plead ignorance later about outrageous behavior that really did undermine American national security.
We're talking to Stephen Clemens. He runs a blog, thewashingtonnote.com, talking about Bolton's confirmation hearings today. Democrats pushing hard for the vote to be delayed. But at this point, as a broadcast, Richard Lugar, the head of the committee, says they are going to be meeting the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at 2:15. Talking about these various revelations, we are also joined on the line by John Nichols. John Nichols has been looking at another aspect of Bolton's career, and we want Steve Clemens to stay on the line with us. It has been largely overlooked in the corporate media, and that is Bolton's role in the 2000 presidential recount. John Nichols of The Nation magazine posted this in his blog, The Online Beat, last week. Quote, Bolton was one of the pack of lawyers for the Republican presidential ticket who repeatedly sought to shut down recounts of the ballots from Florida counties before those counts revealed that Gore had actually won the state's electoral votes and the presidency. The December 9th, 2000 intervention was Bolton's last and most significant blow against the democratic process. John Nichols on the line with us from Madison, Wisconsin. Can you elaborate on what you wrote, John?
Yeah, as you know, Amy, because we've talked about it on the show before, a few years back I wrote a book on the Florida recount crisis called Jews for Buchanan. And did it after things had been finished, went down to Florida and talked to a lot of people about why that process of a recount, which is really a very, very simple process, they happen, you know, on a regular basis in voting districts all over the country, blew up. And one of the answers that people all over the state gave me, and including Republicans on the ground, was that a pack of out-of-state lawyers, mostly from Washington, came in on behalf of the Bush-Cheney team and really did everything they could to delay the counts, undermine the counts, make it impossible for them to go ahead in order to get it into the federal courts with the goal ultimately of getting to the Supreme Court. John Bolton, on November 7th, 2000, the day of the election, was in Korea, South Korea, which, of course, is apropos of the conversation we've been having prior to my coming on the show here. And Bolton flew immediately to Florida. He was put in charge of undermining the recount in Palm Beach County. And you'll remember Palm Beach County was the place where you had so many of the Chad problems. And there are pictures of Bolton, you know, just jumping into situations and forcing people to stop counts. And that stalling of the count in Palm Beach County was a critical part of the screwing up of the whole process. Then when the ballots were taken to Tallahassee after the Florida State Supreme Court ordered a fuller recount, Bolton went to Tallahassee with them, and it was John Bolton who burst into the room on December 9th, 2000, when they were recounting the ballots from Miami-Dade County, one of the most critical of the counties, and announced, "I'm with the Bush-Cheney team, and I'm here to stop the count." Now, Bolton had no power to do that. I mean, he didn't have the authority to stop any count. But he did it repeatedly, and he did it with immense force. And the thing to understand and why this is significant for what we're talking about today is twofold. First off, during that Florida recount process, a number of people who have gone on to become very powerful players in U.S. foreign policy were key members of the Bush team. It wasn't just Bolton. It was folks like Robert Zoellick, who's now the Assistant Secretary of State, former U.S. Trade Representative. They were rewarded very quickly with roles in the Bush administration, but generally those roles were lower-level positions. Now those folks are moving into top international posts or attempting to be moved into these posts. The problem with that is people around the world are often much more aware of the role of folks like Bolton and Zoellick in shutting down the democratic processes in the United States. They are going to be very dubious advocates for the spread of democracy around the world, and they will be countered, as they already have been, when they push for a democratic process by folks like the Zimbabwean leadership who, when criticized for their recent elections, said, look, we're doing a better job than the people who are criticizing us. The people who are criticizing us actually stopped the counting of ballots in Florida.
We're talking with John Nichols, of speaking to us from Madison, Wisconsin, who has been covering John Bolton in other ways. So, Steve Clemens, would you say Bush owes Bolton? He owes him?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think that this is a loyalty issue, and I think, as John laid out, these are very powerful people who I think are not the very best that the country can be sending to posts like the United Nations and others. We should be sending people with impeccable credentials who we could feel proud of, and it is being watched around the world, and we're sending very mixed signals with people like Bolton. But these are issues of loyalty. You know, Karl Rove last night spoke where I'm at right now in Chestertown, Maryland, at Washington College. And Rove bemoaned how the press had sort of created this reality that the press had somehow beaten up on Bush much more than Clinton, and there are all sorts of other realities that Karl Rove spun last night. But one of the really fascinating ones is he bemoaned the fact that we no longer talked about issues and policy and the merits of an agreement, and that we would just agree to disagree. And a student asked a question about John Bolton, and Karl Rove interrupted him and then just began talking about all things Bolton. But essentially, you could see behind Rove's, the illusion that he had tried to create, an obsession with winning, that this has nothing to do with good policy, good public policy, good politics. It has everything to do with winning and rewarding those people who helped the Bush administration to win. And I think that that's got to concern those people who care about the state of democracy in this country and abroad.
Stephen Clemens, do you want to offer a prediction about what is going to happen today?
I think we are on the razor's edge. A lot of people have been focusing on Lincoln Chafee and Chuck Hagel. I think that there is a chance. I think we've got about a 45% chance of winning today. But there's an uncertainty factor that could tilt. When we began this campaign, we had about a 2% chance of winning. So we've clearly moved the environment and made John Bolton known for many, many other things than his outrageous attitudes, which we haven't even discussed, about his view that the United Nations doesn't even really exist in principle. But the other senators, Lisa Murkowski, George Voinovich, Lamar Alexander, these are people who haven't said much at all, and privately they're very, very concerned with some of the things they've heard. And I think it, it,
the Lamar Alexander of past presidential campaign history, ran for Republican
That's
president.
That's right. And they would have to be signing on to someone that they've heard is absolutely monstrous in his behavior towards people, in his vindictiveness towards people, and his recklessness with intelligence. They would have to be saying in future elections that, yes, I knew all of these things, but I virtually had no criteria for voting against this confirmation or this nomination, and basically letting George Bush be the monarch that George Bush wants to be, that we have a Senate to essentially return back to the president decisions that are not good and not within the public interests of the country. I hope that one of them gets hit with conscience when that vote comes up, and I think that we have a modest chance, better than we would have had a few weeks ago. But, you know, he may still get through this hearing, but we have a lot more to share on John Bolton before there's a Senate. You have to remember that Senator Pete Domenici, who's no liberal, actually asked Senator Lugar a couple of years ago to testify against John Bolton in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee because of Bolton's delinquency in tying down nuclear materials in Russia. This is not a guy well-liked, even among moderate Republican circles.
Amy, if I could add.
Yes, John Nichols.
Just the one important thing here is Richard Lugar's in a terrible position because there's a great deal of retribution and punishment to committee chairs that don't go along with the leadership of Bill Frist and obviously the administration's desires. Lugar himself, if you follow him, is someone who's exceptionally uncomfortable with a great deal of the administration's approaches on foreign policy. He's much closer to John Danforth, the brief U.S. representative at the U.N., who obviously left because of his great discomfort with how the Bush administration was trying to make him act. What you ought to watch for with Lugar especially today is a critical decision not to vote against John Bolton, but to delay the process longer. That would be, you know, although it might not seem like a big deal to folks watching or listening to this show, that would be a critical step. It would be, in my mind, Richard Lugar's way of saying, look, this nominee has got to be stopped. I can't do it. I'm not William Fulbright. I don't have that flexibility or perhaps even that courage. But I understand that every day that goes by, and every day that the Washington Note and other important communication vehicles bring out more information on this nominee makes it less likely that he will go to the UN. So in an odd sort of way, the most critical act today may well be simply an acceptance of Biden's request for a delay.
I want to ask a last question of Stephen Clemens, which is not actually on John Bolton. Stephen Clemens, again, senior fellow at New America Foundation, where he co-directs the American Strategy Program, runs the WashingtonNote.com. But also, Stephen, for 7 years, you served as director, executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California, and you co-founded the Japan Policy Research Institute with Chalmers Johnson. And I just wanted to get your take on the row that is going on right now, the all-time low in relations, maybe not all-time, but a pretty low point in relations between China and Japan. China seeing 3 weekends of violent protests against Japan, with many angry about a revised Japanese school textbook that they say whitewashes Japan's wartime history. Also, China opposed to Japan's bid for a permanent seat on the UN Security Council. In just a minute, can you explain what is going on here?
Yeah, very virulent nationalism is being let out of the box in both Japan and China. And regrettably, I feel that the United States is complicit in what's going on. And just to give a very brief take on this, the United States sort of pushed Japan hard recently to state that Taiwan was part of its security concerns, and that if there was an engagement, a conflict between China and Taiwan, and the United States was involved, Japan would support the United States and support Taiwan. This is an agreement, an arrangement that has always been known privately. What mattered more recently is that America compelled Japan to make this a public articulation, and China took great umbrage at what it already knew was Japan's policy. But the overtness of it created pressure on China to respond in kind. In addition, there's a serious effort underway, which the United States supports, to try to get Japan as a permanent member of the Security Council. And beneath this, you have an ongoing uneasiness and, in many cases, a denial of history in Japan that has continually given the Chinese, the Koreans, and others opportunities to continually hit Japan for its failure to acknowledge and reform, like Germany has in some part done, for its World War II and pre-war activities 6 decades ago. So what has come out of the box is essentially an orchestration by China to hit Japan back, both for its global pretensions in the UN Security Council, but also because of our effort to try to get Japan to sort of declare itself in our camp more. Why is that important? Well, China's economic activity with Japan has surpassed American economic activity with Japan. And the United States is very worried that Japan will slowly and incrementally slip towards a greater affection with China. Thus, we wanted more military-oriented declarations from Japan, and this has essentially upended the apple cart, and both governments are basically unleashing their people, and it's very, very dangerous.
Stephen Clemens, I want to thank you very much for joining us, one of the founders of the Japan Research, Japan Policy Research Institute, also writes the blog, thewashingtonnote.com. Thank you, as well as John Nichols. And when we come back from our break, we will be looking at the New York District Attorney's Office preparing to dismiss charges connected to one of the Republican Convention's highest profile arrests. Stay with us. In the City by Enon here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The city of New York has been forced to drop all charges against an activist accused of committing several serious crimes stemming from his participation in the protests at last year's Republican National Convention. 21-year-old Josh Bono said from the beginning he was innocent of all charges against him. On the day of the half-million-person march at the Republican National Convention, a large papier-mâché dragon was set on fire near Madison Square Garden. Police allege at least one of their officers was injured. Police arrested Bono, accusing him of setting the fire. They jailed him for 6 days. His bail was originally set at $200,000. He faced a series of charges, including reckless endangerment and assaulting a police officer. The police charged Bono had matches and an oven mitt in his pockets when he was arrested. The charges forced Bono to move to New York to work on his defense, and his mother had to refinance her house and take a leave from her job. But as the case neared trial, Josh Bono's defense team obtained time-sequence photographs taken by a news photographer at the Daily News that showed that Josh Bono couldn't have set the fire. Well, Josh joins us in our studio today. We are just blocks from the courthouse where the charges against him are set to be dismissed just after the broadcast of this program. We're also joined by his attorney, Sabrina Schroff. She's a member of the National Lawyers Guild. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us. Let's go back to that day. It was the day before the Republican National Convention mass march in New York City past Madison Square Garden. It was just toward the end of the march that this papier-mâché dragon was lit on fire. Where were you?
I was just walking right behind it along with some friends from Arizona. And right in front of us, it just came this huge fire. And we had nothing to do with it. We didn't know who had started it. we were just there participating in the march, and all of a sudden I was under arrest for charges unknown until...
The police just chose you? They just picked you out? Or yeah. Did they also arrest your friends?
No, none of my friends were arrested. It seemed fairly random.
Were other people arrested?
Yeah, other people were arrested, people that I didn't know. But those people also have been vindicated from the photos that we found.
Were they near you?
I really don't know.
So you were arrested, you were held for 6 days?
That's right.
And what has happened to you since?
Since then, it's been 7 months of preparing for trial and searching for evidence and trying to get through this emotionally, and it's been a very difficult situation, but I'm very happy that it's coming to an end.
Did they also charge you with putting a policeman's hand in the fire?
I was charged with assault on an officer, but I never assaulted an officer.
So explain these photographs and why they have surfaced so late. There was one photograph in the New York Daily News, is that right? That showed the fire.
That's right. Yeah, there was one photo that was from the Daily News, and then after Sabrina and a member of the defense team, they decided to track down the photographer and trying to find if there was more pictures from that day from the same roll of film. And after they tracked down the photographer, they found a whole sequence of pictures, one by one, showing that the fire was starting with me standing clear away from it.
And so when were those photographs introduced?
We found them about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Sabrina Sharaf, can you explain the significance of these photographs? We just did a piece a few days ago about another situation. A young man who was near the critical mass bike ride, wasn't a part of it, gets arrested. The case drags on for months. And then videotape is found, actually police videotape, that showed a very different story than what the police had said about him being arrested. And all the charges were dropped. What about these photographs? How essential were they? What exactly position did they show Josh in?
Well, I think you were talking about Mr. Dunlap, correct?
Alexander Dunlap.
Right. Yeah. I think his video, let me just back up. We had a videotape before we ever had the photographs. I think we had the videotape almost by the end of November, December. We turned it over to the district attorney's office somewhere there. And the videotape showed Josh away from the fire. But that wasn't convincing to the district attorney's office, I think, because they articulated that it was not completely exculpatory. The neat thing about the photographs was there was a time sequence, and the very first photograph showed there wasn't even a fire at that time. There was just a little smoke on the left side of the dragon while Josh is standing on the right side. And then the photographer had taken 4 photographs in the same second at 56. And if you look at those 4 photographs, there's just no way Josh could have set the fire and run back and stood where he's shown to be standing in the photographs. I think it was the time sequence that it was all the photographs were taken on that minute that convinced the district attorney's office that this person could not possibly have set the fire and run back.
And yet what the police have charged that they saw you do this?
Yeah, they've been alleging since August that they saw me start the fire, they saw me do all of these other things with people that I allegedly knew, and none of this actually ever happened, and I didn't know any of the people that I was arrested with either.
They were from all over the world?
Yeah, these people, they were from Santa Cruz, California, from Maine, Tennessee, Ohio, and also from France and Italy. It was just a very random mix of people.
They were way ahead of you in the march?
I actually don't know where they were in the march. I know they were arrested someplace else, but I was arrested by myself. They were arrested together somewhere else.
They were arrested a whole block ahead. The theory of the case had to change for them because initially the district attorney said that these other kids formed a human chain link to stop Bono's arrest, which was clearly not the case because they were arrested a whole block, one whole block up. And these kids didn't know each other at all. Not one of them knew the other.
What has this meant for your family? We were talking to a police representative the other day, and they said, that protesters expect to be arrested. They say that they will often hold news conferences that say that's their intention.
Well, I certainly wasn't intending on being arrested that day. I had plans to go back to Arizona to start school again in the fall.
Where do you go to school?
I go to school at Prescott College. And as far as my family goes, this has been devastating for my mother. She's had to go through 7 months of not knowing whether or not her son was going to prison for something that he didn't do. And my
is your mother here in New York?
She
now?
Is, yes.
But she lives in Arizona?
Yes. She's been out here for the last 2 weeks just waiting for the trial, which is not going to happen anymore.
And your sister?
My sister is a student at ASU in Phoenix, and she's also just been absolutely destroyed by all of this. And I know that we're all very happy to finally have this all cleared up. And
your dad? Go.
My dad lives in Fukuoka, Japan, and he's also come out here 2 weeks ago because the trial was supposed to start on the 22nd. But because of a delay, he just saw the city.
And what was your reaction? What was his reaction to the charges against you? Did he believe you or the police?
At first, he was kind of skeptical about what had actually happened. And after we had explained to him that we had photos and pictures and told him the whole story of what actually happened, he was definitely convinced that I didn't do anything. And ever since then, he's been very concerned about what's been happening. I mean, he came from Japan to here just for the trial.
Now, we are talking to you before the dismissal. The DA has announced its intention. Any
We're
thoughts on
waiting.
That?
We're still waiting. But I think one of the things about this case that is problematic is also the over-indictment, the charges that were brought against him. He was charged with reckless endangerment and putting people's life in danger, which was obviously just not the case. That charge should never have been brought on that indictment. That is another thing we tried to convince the district attorney's office to dismiss, and it would have made a difference on the bail that was set on him, on the 6 days he spent in jail. So the case itself raises implications not just simply of innocence, but also of, you know, over-indicting a person just to hold them in. And we're still waiting to hear at 9:30 before Judge White what the district attorney's office plans to do.
Sabrina Schroff, you're with the National Lawyers Guild. New York settled the contempt proceedings initiated by a New York State Supreme Court judge when city officials violated multiple release orders the judge issued on the afternoon of the 2nd in response to habeas corpus writs. Can you talk about the latest, the settlement of almost $250,000 with arrests and false charges?
I think the Guild lawyers, Liz Fink especially, worked tremendously hard to achieve the settlement. I think that the Guild is happy in terms of the fact that people who came to lawfully protest are, in fact, vindicated. And I think that there is at least some recognition now that people were wrongly held. They were held past the 24 hours. And the city just simply disobeyed a lawful order issued by a judge.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. Sabrina Schroff, attorney for Joshua Bano, and Joshua, yourself. Do you leave today? Are you skipping town?
No, I'm leaving today.
To go to Arizona?
This afternoon, yeah.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I'm headed to Tucson, Arizona as well on our Unembed the Media tour. Maybe I will see you there.
Hope to see you.
And that does it for our program. As we continue the Unembed the Media tour tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we'll be at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut, and then at 7 o'clock at West Hartford, a public forum at the Conard High School Auditorium. And we will be headed to California, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Ashland, Oregon this weekend. Looking forward to seeing folks there. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable group of people. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. Thanks to Sharif Abdelkaddous for engineering today. You can go to our website to see where we'll be on the Unembed the Media Tour at democracynow.org. And you can also go there to sign up to get our daily headlines and media alerts, as well as the transcripts and the video and audio programs of Democracy Now! That's democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!